The Cambridge University High Performance Computing Resource, or HPC, much like the Edinburgh Parallel Computing Centre we've just heard about, provides computing facilities to researchers at the university. Paul Kaleja, director of the HPC, showed me around their computer system called Darwin.
What you're looking at is a rack of commodity x86 servers. So we have 32 servers in a rack, and each rack in total contains 128 processors, which you might find in your desktop machine at home.
So I'm guessing with a supercomputer, the important thing to do is somehow to connect these all together. There appear to be some what look like standard network cables and some other connectors which I don't actually recognize.
We have standard Ethernet networks for our data and our administration, and then a specialist network called InfiniBand for our parallel processing. So the InfiniBand network is particularly high bandwidth and low latency, so the time it takes to get a message from one server to the other is very low, and the amount of data we can send is very high.
So this is very important if you've got computers on different sides of the room which are working on the same problem, they might want to communicate, and doing that as quickly as possible is very important.
Yes, in total we have over 800 servers in this one room. Housed in those servers is approximately 4,000 CPU cores, and all servers can talk to all servers at once with a bandwidth of about 3 gigabytes a second.
So what's the advantage of using large amounts of essentially standard hardware over something a lot more proprietary?
The standardization has led to a dramatic decrease in price, so the price point has dropped 100-fold. And also the rate of advance of the commodity market is very high. So we get a doubling of performance every 2 years, which is given to us for nothing from the general advances in the computer industry.
And to explain a bit more about Darwin, Paul now joins us here in the studio. Hi, Paul.
Hi, Dave.
So how does Darwin differ from Hector, which we talked about earlier in Edinburgh?
Okay, so both Darwin and Hector are best-in-class, tightly coupled supercomputers, which means they're designed for the maximum performance in how messages are sent around the machine. So in that respect, they're the same. Darwin differs from Hector in that Darwin is the commodity machine made from standard off-the-shelf components, whereas Hector is a proprietary machine. The processors in both machines actually are commodity, but Darwin has a commodity interconnect, whereas Hector has a proprietary interconnect. So that interconnect which has been spoken about that makes a supercomputer super is open in Darwin. And basically we own all the technology and how it's put together, whereas in Hector your vendor owns the technology.
So I guess this is an advantage, sort of both. It means you get some more flexibility and it's cheaper, because if anyone can build the kit, it's going to be a lot cheaper.
Yeah, well, the more of the value add that you own yourself, the less value add the vendor can charge you for. So you can drive price points down, and also the rate of advancement is quicker. And so this has led to a great improvement in supercomputing over the years.
Brilliant. So what are you actually doing here in Cambridge with your supercomputer?
So Cambridge is primarily used for research in the University of Cambridge, and we have over 400 users on the machine from 65 research groups. And those guys have generated around 300 publications in the last 4 years. So they're very active doing all kinds of science. I can tell you about some of that.
So they decide they want to do something. They then write some code and send it to you and run it.
Yeah, there's a range of activities. So, example, a recent new activity on the machine is the UK QCD Consortium. So this is a consortium of researchers from UK and Glasgow and elsewhere, and they're doing very complicated calculations looking at the nature of matter. So they're looking at the strong interactions known as quantum chromodynamics, comparing that calculation to experimental data that they get from the LHC experiment in CERN. And this is very common. So your scientist has a theory, he has calculations to try to instantiate that theory, and then he compares it to experiments. And these calculations can be very large.
So quantum chromodynamics in the strong force of the forces which hold the nucleus of an atom together.
Yeah, exactly.
And, I've heard that actually calculating them has been almost impossible for a long time.
The grid cells that you're talking about are a million points in your matrix that you have to calculate. And they need to calculate that, you know, over and over again. And then they get expressions of atomic mass, which they can compare very accurately. And even if the two numbers coincide, you know that your theory is correct. And so this is really what simulation is used for in many different areas.
So what else are you up to?
Other things we're looking at, we have a collaboration with the hospital, Bowden Brooks, where they have a gene sequencing facility in the hospital. And they have lots of these next generation gene sequencing machines to look at your gene sequence for particular disease cases. And they generate all the data up there at the hospital, then send it over a 10 gigabit Ethernet link to our machine room in the center of town. We process the data and then send them back the answers.
So they're attempting to compare lots of different genomes and find out which bits of the genomes are associated with different diseases?
Yeah, and in the clinic now, it's quite common that you may well be genotyped for particular diseases, and you need those answers back quickly, obviously. And so they don't have the facilities for doing the calculations at the hospital, and we do, so we've partnered with them for doing that. So that's quite an interesting one. Another interesting project just recently is the Planck satellite. So the astronomy department in Cambridge are collecting lots of data from this satellite called Planck on the cosmic microwave background radiation. And that's an awful lot of data, and that gives you information about the early universe. So again, we get sent lots of data, we calculate it with lots of Monte Carlo simulations, and then send them back the results.
So everything you've suggested up at the moment involves large amounts of data.
Yeah.
Are there difficulties with handling that sort of thing?
Yeah, well, it's often spoke about recently in terms of the data deluge. So data is increasing incredibly fast. So the quantum chromodynamics guys filled up 100 terabytes of disks in about 4 months. That was meant to last them 3 years. Okay, so we now have around 600 terabytes of data. Next year we'll have a petabyte. A petabyte is 1,000 terabytes, and it's just exponentially growing. In fact, data requirements are growing 5 times faster than our compute requirements.
So that's going to be a really major challenge, probably a big challenge in the future.
Yeah, the major challenge at the moment is how you architect your system to allow all that data to flow from the computer to the data. And then once the data's flowed there, what do you do with it? How do you store it? How do you analyze it? How do you keep it?
Sounds like it will keep you occupied in the future. Well, Paul's here for the rest of the show, so if anyone's got any questions for him, then we can ask them later. You can tweet at Naked Scientists right on our Facebook page. That's at thenakedscientist.com/Facebook, or drop us an email. Our email address is chris@thenakedscientist.com. So that's Paul, the director of the Cambridge University High Performance Computing Resource.
Distilling the best science. The Naked Scientists.